Shango, moju ba.
That people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
We're poor, Ashe.
Ashe.
We're poor to the creative spirit, the great Ashe out of which we all emerge, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to that creative spirit by whatever name we know it, whatever name you hold in your heart, in your mind, whatever name your ancestors gave, whatever name you learned as a child, whatever name you believe it to be, whatever name you believe it to be in spirit or in science, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to the first human beings who came into existence on this planet, the first human beings who raised the first structures, who cooked the first meals, who taught the first children, who had the first children, the first Africans, the first people who stood upright, who walked, who figured out how to stay on this planet, who figured out how to pass that knowledge on to their children and their children's children, the mothers and fathers of civilization, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour the next libation to their grandchildren, their children's children, those who raised the great early civilizations of Kemet and Kush and Monomotapa, the great medieval civilizations of Ghana and Mali and Songhai and Kanem-Bornu. We pour to those who great the great civilizations of the Igbo people and the Hausa people and the Kikongo people and the Mbara people, the great Monday civilizations, the great Kikongo, the great civilizations of Southern Africa, the Bantu people, the great civilizations of Southeast Africa, the Dinka, the Shilluk, the Noor. We pour to those millions who raised the foundations from which the world would learn what it meant to be human in the world, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who, upon the arrival on the shores of people they had never seen before, found themselves captured and marched overland, found themselves perishing by the millions before they were held on the holding cells and the open air pens on the coast of West, Central, Southern, and East Africa. We pour to the ancestors who did not know as they were stripped of all clothing and sent denuded into boats, packed like animals and strewn their bones across the floor of the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. We pour to them who in the last moment on Africa grabbed the sand and grabbed the dirt and put it in their mouths and understood that the only thing they might have to preserve their place in that continent was their memory of that place and their ability to pass it on to their children. We pour to them. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to those Africans and their children who, finding themselves cast adrift in Santiago, Cuba, who found themselves cast adrift in Porto, Spain, Trinidad, and Port-au-Prince, Haiti, who found themselves cast adrift in New Orleans and Charleston and Mobile, who found themselves cast adrift in Salvador, Bahia, who found themselves cast adrift in Barbados and the archipelago that formed the Wayward and the Windward Coast. We found them in these places learning Portuguese and Spanish and French, whose often first words was, "Oh my God, oh Madre de Dios," who found themselves praying to survive and pass on to their children the memories. We pour to those ancestors who are represented in the thousands buried in all the square miles of where we stand and who sit here buried before us in 400 caskets forged of wood from West Africa with the Dinka symbols. Each one of them, each woman, man, and child, symbolic of millions. The children of those who could not be killed, we pour, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who somehow survived the hells of enslavement and fought for emancipation in the Caribbean, the French, British, Dutch Caribbean, who fought for emancipation in South America, who fought for emancipation in Central America, who fought the struggles we refer to as the Civil War in the United States, who came out of that, marched out of enslavement through Reconstruction, and found themselves making great migrations, eventually ending up in places like New York. Their children's children, who making a way for themselves became our great-great-grandparents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, our parents. Those who, when the first bones were discovered in this space, held their hands and said, "Stop! No more! We are here to speak for those who can no longer speak with their mouths." We pour for those ancestors, some of whom came to Howard University in 2004 and followed these caskets all the way back to New York. We pray to the great ancestors, the ones whose names we know and the ones whose names we don't. And at this moment, as we pour this libation, I would ask anyone who feels comfortable to say the name of someone in your bloodline who is no longer physically here, but who you know made it possible for you to be here. Go ahead, let's hear the names. Haywood Carr.
Porter Griffin.
Thomas Lee Jr.
Evelyn Glover.
We pour to the names that we hold collective. Ganga Zumba in Brazil. Toussaint Louverture, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and Henri Christophe in Haiti. We pour to the great Avengers, Nanny of the Maroons of Jamaica. We pour to the great ancestors, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Frederick Douglass. Say the names that you study. Who are the names of the ancestors that you have come to hold in your heart and your mind as you hope that you can do what they did for us, for your children and children's children? Let's say some of those famous names.
Malcolm X, Ray,
John Henry Clark, John
Dr.
Jackson,
Muhammad.
Jacob Carruthers. And finally, two final libations. We pour to those who make it possible for us to do what we do. We pour to these rangers who stand guardian over this sacred space. We pour to these Africans and these folks who have come from Howard University, the staff, the faculty, the administrators who brought us here today to bear witness. This is not a libation, but an affirmation, because their hearts still beat, their tongues still speak, their minds still think, and their minds still wish the best for us. We pour for all of those people who surrounded us on this journey today and made it possible for us to be here. We pour this affirmation of thanks, Ashe.
Ashe.
And finally, we pour to your children's children's children who will one day stand on this space and speak your name.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
In 1829, David Walker, a son of a slave but born free in North Carolina, moved to Boston. The next year, he published a pamphlet, Walker's Appeal to the Colored Citizens of the World, which became widely read and infuriated Southern slaveholders. The state of Georgia offered a reward of $10,000 to anyone who would deliver Walker alive and $1,000 to anyone who would kill him. Here is an excerpt.
I asked the candid and unprejudiced of the whole world to search the pages of historians diligently and see if anyone ever treated a set of human beings as the white Christians of America do us, the blacks. I also asked the attention of the world of mankind to the declaration of these very American people of the United States, a declaration made July 4th, 1776. It says, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving that their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of the government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it." See your declaration, Americans? Do you understand your own language? Hear your language proclaimed to the world July 4th, 1776. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Compare your own language above, extracted from your Declaration of Independence, with your cruelties and murders inflicted by your cruel and unmerciful fathers in yourselves, on our fathers, and on us, men who have never given your fathers or you the least provocation. Now, I ask you candidly, was your sufferings under Great Britain 100th part as cruel and tyrannical as you have rendered ours under you? Some of the whites are ignorant enough to tell us that we ought to be submissive to them, that they may keep their feet on our throats. And if we do not submit to be beaten to death by them, we are bad creatures and of course must be damned, etc. If any man wishes to hear this doctrine openly preached to us by the American preachers, let them go into the southern and western sections of this country. I do not speak from hearsay. What I have written is what I have seen and heard myself. The Americans may be vigilant as they please, but they cannot be vigilant enough for the Lord. Neither can they hide themselves where He will not find them and bring them out.
Hotep, and good, happy new year to all of you, my brothers and sisters. My name is William Rogers, and I'm your host this evening here at the Black Reality Think Tank. We thank all of you for being here. I hope you are getting off to a wonderful new year start, and hope that the new year will bring you prosperity, as well as all of the things that you want to do will be fulfilled. We appreciate you. I hope that we had a wonderful Kwanzaa as well, that the seven principles will be able to abide with you throughout the year and through it with our community throughout the year. David Walker's Appeal, which was the last piece that we heard for the opening of our program, powerful document. If you have not read that, I would highly recommend that you make that a part of your New Year's resolution. David Walker's Appeal. Okay, tonight we have a extremely invigorating program. We have a lot of comments that we have received once we posted this program on the air, and it looks as though it might be just some modern phenomena, but it's not. It goes back, like anything does, into history. History is, as Dr. Don Henry Clark said, is a current event. And so tonight's discussion is layered with ideas and thoughts of things that we really must discuss in the salvation and liberation of our community. And these are just one of the things that it does. There's a lot from history that sort of helps us to understand what tonight's program is about. It's called Deconstructing Dolomite, the Mac, Superfly, and Their Images in the Black Community. And as I indicated in the promotion, that these iconic images have plagued the African-American community in the same manner in which we see Sambo, Zip Coon, Jim Crow, and other minstrel acts did during the early years of American life. It was a sad time, but these images remind us of that. So the question becomes, where did they originate? Why does it still exist? Why is it still popular in certain areas of our community? Who suffers the most from these demeaning ideas and images? And so tonight our group, our panel, our community panel, as we've all had, we appreciate so much. We're here to help us kind of understand that just a little bit. We encourage you to call as well and give us your thoughts. The number here is area code 215-490-9832. So for all of our listening audience who are on the internet and you would like to call and make your comments, ask questions, please do so. We would love to have your input. Again, area code 215-490-9832. So please join us at somewhere in our conversation. Well, as we look at our world, as we approach this this new year, it seems that we are heading for self-destruction again. The ongoing battle for this country with the Iranians and some of the other nations that are probably going to be a part of this struggle if it does take place, and it seems like it's already in motion to take place. The problem that concerns me is our boys, our community brothers and sisters who are going to have to go over and possibly shed their blood and lose their lives over a fight that probably most of them don't even know what it is about. But nevertheless, let us keep them in prayer that this does not take place. And obviously, we will get the blunt end of that if it does. So let's keep those thoughts there as we move forward into the rest of January, into the new year. So prayerfully, it won't happen. Okay, we're going to start. I want to get right into our conversation tonight. But as always, I have to do our ancestral profile. We praise and give honor to those whose shoulders we stand upon, who have gone before us and paved the way for us to be where we are tonight. And so we want to give honor to them in our ancestral profile. And tonight I want to talk about a great young brother. His name is Madison Washington. Madison Washington. He was an American enslaved African who served as a cook in most of his life on the plantations of the South. Madison Cook instigated a slave revolt in November of 1841 on board a brigadier called the Creole, which was transporting 134 other enslaved Africans from Virginia to be sold in New Orleans as a part of, as that vast coast-wide slave trade. On the night of November the 7th, 1841, Madison Washington led 17 of his fellow captives into rebellion. They killed one of the slave traders and on board and wounded the crew. They took control of the Creole. They commanded that it be sailed to Nassau, which was under British control. Great Britain had abolished slavery in 1833 in its nation and colonies. Despite American protests, the British declared that the captives, the enslaved Africans who had taken hold of the boat, they should be free persons, and that they were free persons under their law. And they refused the American demands to have them returned. The British took Washington, however, and his 18 conspirators into custody under charges of mutiny. A special session of the Admiralty Court heard the case, but ruled in favor of the men and freed them in April of 1842. The remaining 116 captives had achieved freedom immediately in the preceding fall. Five had remained on the ship, however, and chose to return to the United States and immediately were placed back into slavery. As the 126 enslaved Africans gained their freedom resulting from this revolt, it is considered by many historians as the most successful slave revolt in United States history. There are many who gave tribute to the courage and the wisdom of Madison Washington. The abolitionist Henry Highland Garnett praised him in an address that he had made to the slaves of the United States in 1843. He called him a bright star of freedom and took his station in the constellation of true heroism. William Lloyd Garrison, the abolitionist, also praised him. Frederick Douglass wrote a novel about his life called The Heroic Slave. He published it in 1853. And the lead character was inspired by Madison Washington. And as Douglass wrote a fictional account of this mutiny, his work is now considered the first known piece of African-American fictional literature, Madison Washington. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. We are going to go right into our discussion. Very dynamic topic, as I said. We really love to have your participation. We want to make sure we call upon our audience and those who are here who are going to give some insight into this phenomenon. And so we're going to deconstruct what we feel is this horrible situation and kind of talk about it. What inspired me to really even deal with this topic was obviously the movie that has recently been done by Eddie Murphy on Dolemite Is My Name. It's a Netflix movie that is airing now. I've had a chance to look at it myself. I have also had also an opportunity to look at some of the reviews. Rotten Tomatoes gives it 97%. Others rated 4 out of 5. New York Times gave it a lukewarm review. More quality of their critique was not based on any of the social elements in the film, but more so on looking at the cinematography and the production of it and so forth. But most of the reviews is that I've looked at over the last couple of days has been very favorable to this movie. Many of them feel it was Eddie Murphy's attempt to return back. He had been out for a while, had not done any real movies, and this is his attempt to come back to the forefront once more. But the question I had was, what is it about this character that made it so popular? What makes it that way? Why is it that this movie was made for $100,000 was the budget cost. It has already gained $12 million at the box office. Why are people going to see this? What is it about Dolemite, which most people who are there only know from reading or listening to his albums? I happen to have lived in New York City in the late 60s and 70s when Dolemite was making its position, and he was joining the ranks of the Red Fox and some of the others who were, you know, comedians who were very strong, Moms Mabley and others. And I remember he came, and he was by of no means of the quality of a Moms Mabley or Red Fox, you know, or even Nipsey Russell, Dick Gregory, and all of those who were comedians that I had had an opportunity during those late 60s and 70s to watch on the stage of the Apollo Theater. So what is it about Dolemite? What is it about the game of pimping that attracts young people so much. And we want to look at that and kind of get an idea of the spirit of our community that would embrace that or allow it to be embraced. We know the pimp character that has quite often plagued our communities, usually tied into drugs, nightclubs, and now stripping. But it also may have a very big connection to sex trafficking as well, which is something that we're all trying to attempt to address, and the kidnapping of our daughters. And so as a community, as people that are liberators, soldiers on the battlefield of change, how is it that this image is allowed? Where did it come from? So let's begin by listening real quickly to this interview of a young man who lived the pimp game and was a part of the pimp life and decided to write a book about it and to write a book about the history. And he was interviewed, let's just quickly listen to him.
Right. Tell us, how did the pimping game really, really start, bro?
Well, you understand, it's been a lot of different theories, you understand, on really, really how this ism really got started, you understand, but it really starts back during the slavery times, you understand. I know you're hearing different stories, you know, there's a modern form of pimping, but I'm going to take you all the way back, you understand, to slavery times, you understand, because a lot of people don't know this, but the slave master, the white slave masters would never go out to the villages and get these little young girls in the huts and bring back up there, but what he would do, the slave masters would designate certain men. This is the reason why I keep my hair cut the same way it's cut. You understand? It's the, you understand, the Muddy Waters, the Little Richard style. But it came back from the slave plantation because the slave master himself, you understand, back then brothers couldn't wear fancy clothes, you understand, Armani, Boss, different valley suits and shit like that. So what they would do, the slave masters all would get together and they would make the slaves cut the hair off on the side, something like a rooster. So if a white man was in town, you understand, and this wasn't directly his slave, or if he was coming into town, he could see, you understand, a black man with his hair cut like this. He may be a slave, but he would tell him, you understand, you boy, get over here. And he know that his job, you understand, designated as a rooster, you understand, was to keep up with young girls for sexual pleasures for the slave master. So the slave master would call these roosters, you understand, and tell them, look here, boy, go on out there and get me something sweet. So, you understand, his job then would be going out to the huts to the young girls, some as young as 10 years old, which is sad, you understand, but he would bring these young girls back up to the slave master, to his friends, if they had parties, if they had different events going on. This was his job, to keep up with girls starting from the age of 8 all the way to about 18, 19. He would be designated. This was his job, to keep up with these young girls, to make sure they groomed, make sure they clean, you understand, make sure that everything was cool with them. So when slave master called him to bring these girls up to the house, you understand, his job was to go out there and get them and to bring them back. Now, a modern form of pimping, you understand, when slavery was ended in 1863, you understand, a lot of blacks who was already given this game, you understand, as a rooster, you know, they start taking what the knowledge that they have from the South and start bringing it up to the North, Chicago, New York, you know, Detroit. They was bringing these beautiful young ladies up from the South to sell, and now in prostitution in the bigger cities. And what was happening after World War II, even the mob didn't have no control, you understand, over this pimping, where it was found to be that the mob was owning the whorehouses, you understand, but it was black pimps that was controlling them hoes upstairs. So the mob, believe it or not, my uncle told me the story, you don't have to believe it, but this is a true story. All five members of the five mafia families in 1948, you understand, the Genovese, Gambino, all five in New York got together with Anthony Addoricardo in Chicago to see. This whole meeting was what to do with these black pimps that was coming up from the South. They're coming up not only now with black women, but they bringing them poor white trash white women up, who was now not white trash, but was now Hollywood, New York, and society. The whole meeting was what to do with these pimps, because Italian men can't control these holes, you understand, like the black man who's been doing it already for 300 years because he'd been in slavery for 300 years doing this, and the ism coming down, you understand, is always going to be a black thing. You understand? There's some white brothers that's doing it out there, but you understand, the soul of this game, you understand, is always going to come through a brother. So at this meeting, you understand, Meyer Lansky, who was the brain behind the mafia, he announced that we killing off pimp left and right, and these new black men coming up from the South with the game, it's like killing roaches or ants. We can't kill them as fast as they're coming up. So they decided to say, 1948, you let a pimp pimp, but now we're going to charge a tax. We're going to pimp the pimp for pimping. So you understand, that's a modern times where now brothers in Harlem, yeah, Chicago, you understand, LA, now they driving Cadillacs, Holmes and Bromes. So believe it or not, pimping was introduced and founded by the white man on the slave plantation. You understand, it came modernized in the 40s, and now pimping is looked upon as an evil and wicked vice, but it was originated by the white man. But now they look.
Okay. And it still plagues our community today. So let's go to our audience. Let's go right into this discussion. I don't want to hold up in just a minute. Happy New Year to you, Dr. Belcher. How are you doing?
I'm blessed. Happy New Year, Bible.
Thank you. When you hear that, and you hear that discussion, and you look at those images that are posted on our announcement for the program today, as a black woman who is a fighter, you're a soldier, you're trying to make change in our community, you're trying to bring male, female together as a big part of your women's ministry. What do you think? How do you feel? What comes to your mind?
Well, clearly I'm not a fan. I'm disappointed in Mr. Murphy, Eddie, that after his long-term hiatus, quasi-retirement, that the very best that he could bring us back, come back with him, is this?
Yeah.
You know, is this the best that you can bring back as a role model for our young people in our community who is already struggling to find something to hold on to that will help them identify who they are, you know, where they came from and where they're going? And this the best he could bring back for our young people and our community? Yeah. I'm disappointed.
Yeah. Okay. Brother Timothy, you from a city? I think Philadelphia was the home of the Ward brothers. Am I right? Wasn't that the Ward brothers from Philadelphia? They were the notorious pimps of the late 70s and 80s.
That's true, sir. Just like it was very popular in Detroit. Detroit was also known for their pimping, also.
Okay. Right.
And
what's your thought?
Yeah. Well, my thought is that I learned from a man who came from the Nation, and he talked about his experience as a pimp, a person who had a drug habit and a drug deal. And that was Malcolm X.
Right.
And Malcolm X said that he was pulled out of that from Elijah Muhammad and his teachings. And he went back, just like that man said, to the slave plantation. And he may even go further back than that. But listen to me. Any man that puts any woman out on the street is one of the lowest things in the world. I'll tell you that right now. And if you, as a man and a woman, your nation comes through her, which is the male child or the female child, when it puts your generation in jeopardy like that, then your self-destruction tells you that whatever got you there, you need to take it away and take anybody away from it who put you in that direction. Mm-hmm. So I'm against Eddie Murphy, like the doctor said, coming back like that. He could have came back with something else. And I'm just going to say this, I'm going to let you go. He had a nerve to talk about Bill Cosby. At one time, he didn't talk about Bill Cosby at all. If Bill Cosby did what he did, I didn't like it. The women could have been all white, black. They could have been any nationality. Any man who did that, drug somebody to do what they had to did, is wrong. Mm-hmm. But my thing is, for him to talk about Bill Cosby, he's in jail. Let the system deal with him. He had to step on him to get up. He's making a bad comeback in the wrong direction.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I like that. I like that. Brother Pugh, let's talk about the economic part of this. This is do you think an argument could be made that this existence has a lot to do with the economic exploitation of the black community, obviously not having any ability to, you know, have any type of resource, that this undermarket black market lifestyle is. I mean, and we see it in other ethnic groups as well. I mean, black folks not the only one. In the early years of the immigrants coming to the New World, and the opportunities weren't there. They went into bootlegging liquor and gambling and prostitution and all kinds of things. Is there a strong enough argument can be made somehow or the other to make us better understand how this could exist? What do you think?
Well, in terms of economics, I know quite a few people who came up as pimps or hoes and transformed that into other kind of businesses. But the fellow's completely wrong. Pimping, you know, in fact, they talk about prostitution being the oldest profession. So you can go back, you know, thousands of years and you'll find pimps. So that mentality. In fact, when you conquer a people, aside from killing the people, you know, you essentially use the other people for whatever your purposes might be. And so, that's where the mentality comes from. Mm-hmm. But to your specific, now I'm not sure what your question is. Are you asking me, is there an economic basis for pimping or I don't,
well, I mean, is what is it that we can understand as a motivator, for doing this, that maybe if the economic conditions of the community were a lot different and we had better control of our resources and the things around us, that this type of thing might not happen, just like drug dealing.
Well, that's why it's the oldest profession, because one of the things that happens is that once you conquer a people or marginalize a people, now all of a sudden the traditional ways they have to survive are not available. And now they have to scavenge or come up with some other kinds of ways of surviving. And that happens to be one. I think I always tell the story about this Himba woman in Namibia, she's a gathering and hunting woman, and her culture, you know, has been destroyed by the Germans and white people down there. And so she was sitting on the edge of some city or some little village, getting ready to go into the village. Now, she was either going to become, she was probably going to become an alcoholic, prostitute, or something like that, because she didn't have the kind of skills that it took to function in that environment. And so if she was going to survive, mm-hmm. it was going to be, you know, at some kind of low-level hustling. So, yeah, that's where it comes from. Unfortunately, in the case of black men in America, the ones I've known, they consider pimping as somehow or another honorable. And where the honorableness comes from, excuse me?
No, I'm just saying, right. You're right about that.
Honorableness comes from is Norman Mailer in 1957 wrote an essay called The White Negro. And it was about, you know, whenever you hear people talk about uptight society and all that kind of stuff. Well, the whole concept is that there's a kind of hip way to be in the world, and that white people need to learn that hip way, and black people are the model to, you know, the path, you know, to that hip way. And so that's been one of the cachets that blacks have used. In fact, the fellow that you first interviewed, when he was talking about the real thing come from the black man, but other people get, I mean, you know, he's, you know, trying to play on that kind of, you know, that there's somehow or another some style associated with pimping that uniquely blacks can do. But let me just make one final statement. Mm-hmm. I had said on your Facebook that pimping was black men who internalized the values of white men. Mm-hmm. And I think that statement is correct. But I said on the Facebook that Donald Trump exemplifies the value of white men. And I think that statement is too extreme. Trump is a Hitler. He's a psychopath. Mm-hmm. He's at a whole nother level. So in other words, at the limit of the pimp mentality, you'll get Trump. But you got to be, way, way deeper than a pimp to get to somebody like Trump.
Right.
Because he doesn't care about anybody, right, except for himself, right?
Right, exactly.
Whereas pimps don't, in other words, when you look at a psychopath, a narcissist, a sadist, and a Machiavellian, a pimp is a Machiavellian because he manipulates people. Mm-hmm. A pimp is a narcissist because he's concerned first and last about his own self. But he's not a psychopath. He does, have empathy for other human beings. And he's not a sadist. He doesn't get pleasure, out of the punishment of other people. And so when you start thinking about the ideal of the Nazi, where, their ideal is that there is no right or wrong, good or evil, it's just whatever I want to do. Well, that's a mentality, I think, that needs to be reserved for very few people.
Right, I agree. Thank you for that. I really appreciate that. And you're right, because there's a lot of factors. As we said, as I opened the discussion, there's a lot of factors here. And obviously one of them is a psychodynamic factor, this whole narcissistic spirit that goes along with this, having to wear mink coats to the floor and driving Cadillacs with all kind of design that actually look buffoonish. They don't even carry any taste with it. But, still, it's done to make people stand out, to show themselves off, to show that I am somebody, that they need this as a way of doing that. I mean, we're all familiar with the guy that they call Bishop Don Juan out of Chicago. He's one of the clear examples of that. That imagery type thing. I equate it as a historian right along with the minstrel, the buffoon type of image as well. This is the season of Mardi Gras. You'll see a lot of that in terms of their parading and, the symbolism that came out of the Mardi Gras era. You will see those kind of images a lot. The Amos and Andy, if we think about it, again, and I'm just calling out those psychological connotations that we would have to look at the Kingfish and Andy Brown, the way they dressed, like Brother Pugh said, they're internalizing white men, and so they sit around with big cigars and derby hats and talk like white men, attempt to do that. And then also, I to balance this out, you also got white men. The Italians are very flashy in their dress and their demeanor. A lot of them drive big Cadillacs, the same way. And even though they are able to go further in the game with things, it's a concept, though, when you look at our community. It's damaging because young people, like you say, they want to be like that. They want to see that. That's what they see. That's the image. They don't see all the time the doctors and the lawyers. They don't see the accountants and the CPAs and the educators and teachers. They see the pimps and players. They want to dress like that, look like that. I remember when I first went to New York, I was around 19 years old, 18, 19. And I remember going over on 125th Street on the same street that the Apollo was on, between 8th and 7th Avenue. And they have a men's clothing store on that same side of the block of the Apollo called A.J. Lester. And A.J. Lester's has been well known for the boutique of the pimp world. And they had clothes in there. They would always be in the window, there dressing out. Sit there and look at those clothes. And I mean, some stuff was nice. They had nice sweaters and all kind of things, but it was only the upper crust of the black community that would shop there. A lot of the entertainers, when they would come, would go there. James Brown used to go there and shop in A.J. Lester. I remember Mike Tyson got into a scuffle with somebody there at A.J. Lester's when he was coming out of the store. He got into a little scrap. So it's been around a long time. I don't know if it's still there or not. But it's been well known. In Milwaukee, you had Johnny Walker's, the Johnny Walker boutique, which was also a store. And so there's a system that feeds that mentality, and it continues to do that. And it really has become destructive. And so now it loops itself in possibly what may be the sex trafficking business. And we'll talk about that later, just a few minutes, but I just kind of want to look at kind of explaining that this whole, what was always known as the pimp game. And there's a lot of folk out there. I think this is Sister Yan. Is that you, Sister Yan?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Are you open to discuss question, answer a question I want to ask you?
Yes, definitely.
Okay.
Definitely.
All right. You're from New York as well. You lived in New York, born and raised in New York City. At least you lived in New York City enough to know. What was your impression as a young woman coming up of the hustlers and the pimps of New York? And I know you mostly lived in Brooklyn, but they had it too. Over there on Fulton Street and down Notion Avenue, you know, you had all the pimps and hustlers over there as well. What was your impression of that as a young woman coming up? Did that impress you?
Actually, I had a cousin who was, they called him a player,
uh-huh.
But as I look at his behavior and the way that he dressed, as you know, once I started getting older, he was pimping.
Right.
He was pimping. So I had someone doing it in my family. This man was tall, and he was good-looking, and he wore different garb every day. He would wear all black velvet from head to toe one day. The next day, he'd have some kind of beautiful red, you know, from head to toe, from hat to shoes, everything red. He wore extremely expensive clothes. He had good taste, but a lot of it was still clowny.
Right.
And I want to make the point that one of the stupid things that pimps did was to dress like clowns, and we thought it was good looking. You know, that's mm-hmm. just an indication of our mental side. So yeah, I had one in my family, and I would see it at the movies because I was younger, you know.
Right.
But I knew of it. I knew of it, and then of course there was my cousin, and I thought it was just the worst, filthiest thing that a man could do to a woman. Before I continue, what was your specific question?
Just because you were a young lady at the time that it was in those early years, and I was just wondering what was your impression and your peers. You know, were you turned on by it? Were you turned
stupid.
Off by it?
Stupid. knuckers. All right, I'm not going to say the N word. That was my impression.
Because
we were young during the era of Black Power.
Right.
So we were not admiring any of that. It was ridiculous. Like I said, they looked like clowns,
right.
And not impressed at all. And then once, you know, we saw the movie Superfly, and you know, and we heard about. So of course there was violence toward women. You know, everything that we saw was negative and ignorant.
Right.
So that's my impression. And, you know, the tone of my voice, I don't know if anyone could tell, but I hate it. I hate the idea of pimping. Black men that do that, I feel that they need to have some consequences to treating women like that. I don't care what the origin is.
Okay.
I also think, yeah, because I'm actually, yeah, this is a subject that pisses me off.
Okay.
I think
good.
That Eddie Murphy is a jackass.
Mm-hmm.
For somebody that brilliant, that he's a brilliant comedian in my eyes, for him to do something like that as a comeback. And I watched some of the movie on Netflix, and it was a total turnoff.
It was.
I feel his acting was crappy. His acting was crappy. He was a much better actor. He did a much better job in some of the movies, you know, the movies that were popular,
right.
in the media. But this movie, it was crappy every which way.
Right.
And I was just saying to myself, why would he do something like this as a comeback?
Hmm.
So that part is confusing. But my, you know, what I came up with is that he has to be a jackass, and I don't have any respect for him anymore.
And you know what even surprises me more, considering what, for instance, what Wesley Snipes did with John Henry Clark and some of the things that the fact that he even in this movie, he plays the Earl Martin. And I think that the role, it was a whole, the role of a homosexual. It too surprised me that he would participate in something like this. You know, I guess maybe it's his friend, and I guess he was just kind of responding to it. I don't know. A lot of that surprised me as well, because that was...
Well, you know, the other thing, I didn't know he was in there. I lost respect for him, too, because I think it was a stupid movie. There was nothing entertaining about it.
Right.
I turned it off. I couldn't watch the whole thing.
Right.
Just because it was stupid, and it was literally boring to me.
Yeah.
The other thing, a point I want to make, you know, you talked about the psychological aspect. Pimping is an expression, the epitome of the expression of self-hatred. And of course, when you hate yourself, you hate people that look like you. And right. It also is a manifestation of low self-esteem and low self-worth. Whenever you got to dress up like a peacock, I don't care if it's those clownish looking pimp clothes or these long ridiculous eyelashes that, you know, sisters are wearing now with all these extensions where we don't know where those fabrics come from, mm-hmm. or those whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
when you got to dress up like that to the extreme, that is an expression of low self-esteem, because you don't feel good inside, so you've got to put a whole lot of work into looking like what you think is good
that's
on the
right.
outside.
That's right. And most of them had their hair. They had processed hair, you remember?
Yeah. Burning your scalp up. Mm-hmm. And none of that was attractive. When I look at this stuff through sane eyes, it's not attractive.
Mm-hmm.
My father had a process, and I love my daddy. But when I see pictures of him with his process, then his afro, like, the process looks stupid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's just very unfortunate that we copy the ways of the, you know, the sociopath, mm-hmm. the European. We copy their ways and exploit each other in, all, you know, whatever they do, we turn around and do it to each other.
Right.
You know, but then again, that's the part of our sickness. So I'll wrap up by saying, if we can identify this and understand these types of behaviors, pimping, the drug dealing, et cetera, as, you know, mimicking, copying the behavior of sociopaths and the exploiter, and then turning around, you know, doing these things to each other, and recognize it for what it is, expressions of low self-esteem, et cetera, maybe we can combat this, because we can't allow, you know, as a revolutionary, I'm all about fighting back.
Right.
And we can't allow this to just go on without high criticism and saying, no, this is unacceptable.
Right. That's exactly right. You're listening to the Black Reality Think Tank. I am your host, William Rogers. We are talking about deconstructing Dolemite, the Mac, Superfly, and their image in the Black community. If you have some thoughts or questions or just ideas that you would like to share with us, please call area code 215-490-9832. I repeat, 215-490-9832. We would love to hear from you. We'd love to hear you give us a contribution, even if you feel that pimping, you don't see a problem with it. You know, I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to hear that perspective of why you don't think that is something that we should not have in our community or be a part of. So we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call, and we'd be glad to take your call. I want to ask Brother Griffin. Brother Griffin, I know you. I got you by a few years, but I think you probably are old enough to remember Dolemite and Rudy Ray Moore when he came to the stage. Was that as a young man? And I would have been. Let's see. I was in my 20s when Dolemite came to the forefront. What do you think, Brother Griffin? Were you impressed with Dolemite? Do you remember him, Rudy Ray Moore?
Can you hear me? Good evening, Dr. Rogers.
Good evening, my brother, and Happy New Year to you too.
I can tell you right away. I'm in alignment with the first sister that spoke and the last one that spoke. And I must be honest with you, I'm not into movies, but I did enjoy the 78s when my uncles and his crew were sitting around. I was DJing and stuff for them, so I got the laughter part of it.
Right.
So I want to bring it back to start it with. When I first got hold of this, I started listening to interviews from Eddie Murphy. And I tell you, from my point of view now at 66, I don't have the same view of those people at 66 that I had at 16. And part of my problem with Eddie Murphy is he exemplifies exactly what's wrong with where we are. I don't see any maturity or growth from him because he acquired money, but he doesn't give a two rat butt about his people because he has the power and influence to have done something positive, especially with everything that's going on in the last decade, from devastating black wealth by the first black president. Right, you're looking at Black Lives Matter. You're looking at a current organization that I do a lot of research for, ADOS. When you look at all the possible things he could have done with his money, the best thing he can do is try to bring back something from 40 or 50 years. And people keep telling me it's only entertainment. But they don't understand. Entertainment is a form of what? Education.
That's right.
You're educating
us
right back into the very same thing that got us here. So I'll leave it right there in a short comment. All of this mess about the psychological part of it and where it started, none of that really matters to me, because if you're not learning a damn thing from history, you might as well not even know what the hell it is.
That's right. I agree. Thank you. Thank you. I really agree with that. You know, and it's so interesting. I remember Dolemite. Rudy Ray Moore was not funny to me. And like I said, he came out in the era generation of Red Fox, Dick Gregory, Moms Mabley. You know, they were funny. Now, that was funny. I mean, even though the forces of their joke sometimes might have not be something that was all the way totally ethical. But it was, I would be more apt to listen to Red Fox, Nipsey Russell, Miles Mabry, much easier than. I didn't like Rudy Ray Moore. He wasn't funny to me. The only thing that Rudy Ray Moore, I felt, now this is from a personal opinion, is that his albums are all mostly very closely X-rated. His album covers, particularly his covers. You buy a Rudy Ray Moore album cover, you're gonna see some raunchy stuff on there. And that was coming of the age of raunch. It was beginning to pick up around the late 70s, the platform shoes, and the image that, Robert Townsend put in I'm Gonna Get You Sucker. Some of that imagery was coming out as a part of a lot of that. And one of the things that's really interesting, and we'll talk about this at some point, is that a lot of this we're talking about, this pimping, this game is tied into black music, because even a lot of the musicians and a lot of the songs that were created and done were songs that were basically in support of the big pimping game. And how it all worked, and it was looking at it as though it was an honorable kind of thing. Superfly, you know, the Mac, people like Curtis Mayfield, and I always considered Curtis Mayfield a liberation singer, but he sang about the Mac, the Pusher Man, and some of those ideas of people that were very destructive to our community. But in a sense, as though, like Brother said, it was glorifying, it seemed to have been glorifying this game. And very clearly, the rap game, as the rap began to move, they quickly embraced the big pimps. Snoop Dogg went all the way with it. I'll never forget, never, ever forget, which I thought was the most, almost made me want to cry. He did something in some program or stage where he came out on stage and he had two women in chains with harnesses, like a dog harness. And he called it, it was the dog pound. And I thought that was the most disgusting thing. And these women were tied to these leashes. And he was walking out with a big, long coat on, pimp-like hat. And he came out promoting and dealing with it in that way. So that was an ugly
ugly image. And our young folk, you know, because of who he was, did that. And today now that has transferred into strip clubs because the strip clubs are now also supporting a lot of their success has to do with the rap songs and the type of rap music that is played in the strip clubs. And there's a business that goes on with the DJs and the rap clubs and the women. One of the artists, the young man T.I. in Atlanta. T.I. Just became part owner of a strip club in Atlanta. And he put out a promotion that he was looking for dancers. And the women started lining up about 3 o'clock in the morning. And when you finally got there, we opened early, they said it was thousands of women had come to apply for a job as a stripper in T.I.'s club. This is the same person that had a reality TV show where he's got sons and daughters that he's using and playing about, but at the same time he promotes that along with his music because the strip game now also promotes the music game. And so if you want to be an up-and-coming rap star, I understand to get your music in a strip club is the way to go as opposed to maybe going on a radio station and trying to get your music there. I got my brother from Atlanta. What about your understanding of this whole big pimping game, even how it's tied into rap music, strip clubs, you know, drug dealing? What's your understanding living in a city that's sort of like the capital of all of that? What you think about this whole thing? Brother, 770-943? Okay, maybe you don't.
Hey, Dr. Rogers.
Yes.
Good evening.
Oh, hi, good evening. I was thinking that this was a young man that calls us all the time from Atlanta. I apologize. But if you do it...
That's quite all right. And I'm your former neighbor from Milwaukee.
Oh, okay. All right, great. If you have you got a thoughts around this
yes.
crazy
Actually,
phenomenon?
I find it interesting that I too saw the Dolemite movie just because I wanted to see what was the newest thing and why it came back. Didn't like the original.
Right.
Didn't like the remake. But with all of that, it's still a matter of we tend to criticize Eddie Murphy and other people who were in the movie when we realize also how much there was a miseducation that went along with that.
Right.
So they're victims of it as well, and they need to have some sort of correction in their minds and a consciousness raised.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry, in case of Mr. Snipes, maybe it's re-raised. But people who are like in their 50s and younger still have the attitude of, this is what I saw. Mm-hmm. Generations before me made it something great. For those of us who saw people like Ron O'Neill in Superfly and thought, yes, this is really cool. And yet my father took me to that as a young girl and said, you will never allow a man to treat you like this.
Right. Exactly. Good. Yeah. Exactly.
And this is IBK from, like I said, used to be your neighbor. And you know that I told the same thing to my daughter. But we have to educate other people that that's just not acceptable. And one of the things that we push is you will, for all the times we've told people, get your hustle game together, do what you have to do in order to make money.
Mm.
That's what these things exploit us with and color our minds so that we don't see the negatives of it. We don't see what the message is that's bad. What we see is who are the people that we need to go after. I don't think Eddie Murphy was the sole producer of that movie. Who benefited from it? And are we not right back to your discussion about pimping and where it originated?
Right, right. Dr. Belcher.
Yes,
One of the interesting things, as we just indicated, is the connection that all of this has with other activities of African Americans in the community. Music, as I said, you know, the nightclub business, the liquor, you know, so forth. This pimping is gelded right into all of that. One of the other areas it's gelded into is religion, and the black church. A lot of the imagery of pimps is also carried over to the preaching game. As a matter of fact, the Chicago pimp Don Juan calls himself a bishop. He now has a church, and his church is that. How do you see that? What do you think that means? You know, as you look at it, you know, basically only from your interpretation. Why bring it over to religion? What is it that can do to promote or carry forward the ideas of all of that?
Well, let me before I hit that real quickly, let me just backpedal on what the caller just said with regard to Mr. O'Neill, Ron O'Neill, the late Ron O'Neill. He was the original actor in the original Superfly by Gordon Parks Jr. back in 1972, I think it was. But Ron O'Neill himself said this, that there is, and this is a quote, there is something dangerous about priest as an idea. Priest was the character he played in the original Superfly, you know, was this young cocaine dealer in Harlem, you know, was trying to, you know, get out of the game because the criminal element of that whole game was pressing in on him. He was trying to find a way out, okay? But he said that the idea of priest, of that character he played, is very dangerous. And it's a dangerous thing, and it upsets a lot of people. And he's right about that. And the dangerousness of that is all of the things we discuss on this panel, on the call that come in, and in what you just said, this carryover into seeing what else can we use to pimp, you know, what else can we use to manipulate to try to get ourselves some money, you know. So let's look at the church, you know. Nothing sacred.
Okay.
When you're talking about this kind of mentality, this narcissistic, sadistic, buffoonery of a mentality of thinking, you know, and the whole idea that they are looking for other things to carry it over into. You mentioned they're looking at the rap industry, the music industry, now they carry this over into it under the guise of strip clubs. Now they're looking at the church as, you know, as a way of saying, okay, I'm going to just call myself bishop somebody and I'm going to go out. I mean, people can do what they want. You know, people can do what they want in the name of God. I mean, we know that that's going to happen in the name of God. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people are pretty savvy about knowing what's real and what isn't. You know, if you not pray about it, watch your truth come to you. But you know, it's a mess like that. Ain't no God in that. Mm-hmm. That's for certain. It is not going to happen. But I think we owe a duty and a responsibility to our community and to our children to say, hey, look, and everything doesn't go in the name of entertainment. You know, rap music, be it rap music, now using strip clubs, which is attached, linked to trafficking, all that stuff, you know, or be it the whatever. We have a duty and responsibility as elders to cry loud and stand out. In 1972, I was a child, you know, I was a young child, but I remember it. I mean, I remember, you know, Curtis Mayfield. I remember the albums. I mean, because that was my parents' music.
Right.
You understand?
Right.
That was their thing. So, I mean, I grew up around it. I hear it. I knew about all these movies and all these things. Rudy Ray Moore, Red Fox, all of that. I mean, that was the kind of stuff my mom would send us out the house, you know, because when her friends and them go there, listen to that stuff.
Right, right.
So they didn't want us to be influenced. But see, our parents had enough, you know, to know that I don't want my kids either. Mm-hmm. But nowadays, it's like we ain't got no stopping sense in our community, Mr. Murphy, Eddie. We don't have any stopping sense, no sense of duty and responsibility to not continue to perpetuate something that was wrong. I don't care if it goes back to pre-slavery, post-slavery, 5,000 years ago. Wrong is wrong. Wrong was wrong last week. Wrong is wrong this morning.
Right.
Now, here we already can get these kids, and when I say kids, I'm talking from, like, I don't know what, 17 to 42, to pick up a book. Okay?
Right.
You can't even get, it's hard enough to get them to come and sit down and just listen to you, or you go to them and they hear you to try to educate them. The caller talked about education. Well, where are they supposed to go get that from? You know, if we could have, I'm telling you, even now, with what I'm doing right now is putting on this huge conference through our ministry here in Milwaukee, you know, to try to talk about was the construct for African descendants to live under, what those relationships are supposed to look like, how to identify who you are, whose you are, where you came from, so you know where you're going. It's like pulling teeth to get people to register for this powerful educational conference. We've been bringing people in from Africa to try to teach them, as well as scholars like yourself, Dr. Rogers, and others right here in this community who want to help you. But let me say this: if I say I'm bringing in Black China, okay, if I was bringing in Black China, who's going to do a strip tease act or something at a conference, it would have been sold out last month. I would have to get a large venue. I would probably go down to the arena somewhere down there and book this thing. And, you know, somebody said something to me last month. At first, I mean, my knee-jerk reaction was to be offended and say, no, not my people. Right. Because what they said to me was, oh, girl, look, you're putting on this huge educational conference, and these people are more interested in entertainment than education. And I said to them, you're absolutely, I'm sorry.
Turn your, I think you have a radio on or something in the background.
I have nothing on. I have nothing on here.
Because I'm picking up a reverberation from you. Okay, all right, I'm sorry.
Then. It wasn't from me, it was from someone else.
Okay.
But what was told to me is you're putting on this huge educational conference. We're doing it in partnership with the other young Black people, the Black Student Union of Cardinal State University. And someone said to me, well, Black people in this community are interested in being educated, coming to an educational conference. They don't want education, they want entertainment. That's the other E they want. And I was highly offended. And, you know, and I, of course, offended my community.
Right.
You know, but I have to be honest that it's a bit challenging to get people to embrace this.
Yes.
As opposed to Rudy Ray Moore or Dolemite.
That's right.
Or that Superfly movie. Yeah. That flopped, by the way. The last one, it flopped big time, and it should have.
And a lot of our community is praising Netflix and these folk that produced that movie as cutting-edge kind of entertainment. I look at the reviews before today's program, and I wanted to make sure that, you know, what was going on. And so it's really being supported, but that's interesting. Let me ask Brother Griffin, you had mentioned the fact that you said pimping pastors and politicians, they all get respect. Could you mind explaining that just a little bit? I mean, I think I know what you mean, but just for the sake of our discussion, what do you mean they all get respect?
I'm no expert on it. I'll just tell you, this is one of the things I said since 1970, Air Force started down this country. I think a conversation, no matter whether it was a small group or we close to the street, automatic respect, whether they respect.
Your mic is going a little bit in there, but I did understand mostly what you said. Okay, all right, and you're right. I mean, you can go back that far, even farther than that, and say that is true. You know, pastors do a lot of symbolic pimping. You know, the church buys them cars. They have clothing allowance in some cases. I know churches that have clothing allowance for their pastor. They want them to look a certain way and dress a certain way and drive a car in a certain way and live in a certain way. And they're willing to do that for someone. So, you know, there's something going on in there that, and like I said, that really has to really be discussed. I see my brother from Montgomery, 334-414. How you doing, Brother Lipson? How you been?
Hi, good evening, Dr. Rogers. I just couldn't wait to get home.
That's okay.
Happy holidays to you.
Same to you.
Holidays.
Same to you.
And I just had to kind of, you know, myself situated of sorts. I was hearing the words pimping and prostitution and Black exploitation, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, I don't know if the name Robert Beck was ever raised, or his other name was called Iceberg Slim. Was right there at Tuskegee University, an educated individual of some sort. You know, I kind of wonder, especially when you're talking about this kind of topic, could we throw King Solomon in that kind of arena.
Say that once more. Can
he
we do
it? He did have concubines, did he not?
Yes.
Yeah. So we wouldn't, in the way that we're looking at it and defining it, we wouldn't want to, I don't know, maybe some people would throw King Solomon in that kind of type of arena or close to it. You know, there are some things that I think can be learned from those who are in that kind and type of arena. And I thought about Iceberg Slim, who had the book Trick Baby and a couple of others as well, who was really in and showed the kind and type of dynamic, not so much as exploitation, but those kinds and types of individuals who were well aware of what was going on at the current time, right?
Right.
And so they were able to articulate through their way of sorts a kind of communication, a way with words with other people to be able to have things flow, ebb and flow. So, you know, I know it's a, I've never been a pimp or anything of that nature. I've kind of saw them from a distance, originally coming from New Orleans and now discovering that Robert Beck was walked the grounds of Tuskegee University.
Right.
So it's just interesting, though, the kinds and types of individuals they are and the kinds and types of things that they present with regards to reasoning, with regards to their form of logic of sorts. So I just had to throw that in.
That's good, and that's a good thought, too. That leads me to some other things I want to ask our women guests that are on as well. But before I do that, I want to ask Brother Pugh, because he is from Milwaukee, and or at least originally he lived in Milwaukee for a minute. Brother Pugh, what do you, you know, Iceberg Slim spent a lot of his time in Milwaukee, and there were a lot of other notorious guys of that ilk, people like Kenny Ivey and some of these others. They're the ones that created that HBO documentary called Pimps Up, Hoes Down. That came out of Milwaukee, and which was an HBO special. Do you see, what is the environment that you saw in Milwaukee that would encourage that kind of thing? And let me just add to that, because there are some people say, well, that's a carryover from Chicago. I don't know if I agree with that argument. But what is it about Milwaukee's environment that would embrace pimps up, hoes down type of mentality, or either things like Iceberg Slim? And you know, some of the clubs and places in Milwaukee we know that has that history behind it. What do you think? What did you see that embraces that?
Well, one of the things that differentiated Milwaukee was that it was a highly, it was a heavily industrial city, mm-hmm. Where you could get the highest wages with the lowest education in America.
Okay.
You know, when blacks began to come up to Milwaukee, it was for that reason. You know, working in foundries and whatnot, in the 50s and 60s, you could be making, you know, $25 and $30 an hour. So what was happening was that, and by the way, I used to do pimping, you know, back in the day. And I want to say a couple of things. They weren't buffoons, because you look at Prince and his style, that's a pimp style, what Prince does. And nobody would say that's clownish. Uh-huh. It's the highest level of presentation. But the mentality was, the idea of, Well, let's understand this. The nation state is based on the concept of pimping, that you conquer a people and you basically live off them, right? That's the concept of a nation state. Mm-hmm. And right. So what happens is that you get the mentality of black men that I knew was that they're these squares who are working in a system that doesn't benefit them. And that I'm hipper than that, I'm slicker than that, and I don't have to do all that. And similarly, the same thing for the women, mm-hmm. that they were looking at the kind of lifestyle that was available to them along one path and contrasting that with the kind of lifestyle available to them as a whole and saying, hey, this lifestyle is better. And so on. So, I mean, so I would say that the mentality is that you want to be successful and you don't believe that you can be successful by being a teacher or a preacher or the kind of things that were available to black people at the time. You certainly didn't think you could be successful simply as a laborer. And so you start imagining being a hustler. Mm-hmm. And the limit of mm-hmm. a hustler was a pimp in the sense that, you know, this was a person that had had sophistication, style and grace, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, these were attractive people. These weren't buffoons. I don't know where that's coming from. By the way, let me just make one other statement. In the 1990s, I used to sit around talking about Tyler Perry like he was a buffoon and all, you know, his movies and whatnot, even though I enjoyed them.
Right.
I was in Atlanta recently, and one of the things I did is went to Tyler Perry's, studio. So,
right.
You know, so I just kind of, you know, as everybody was talking about buffoons, I was saying, well, now hold it now.
Well, yeah, he's a rich buffoon. Yeah, right. Yeah, that's true. And that was the same way with Burt Williams. Burt Williams was one of the richest black men in America during the time he was performing his blackface. You know, you laugh at him and call him, but he was rich. So that's why I asked you earlier about the economics of all of this. You know, is this what we've been relegated to because we can't get into the mainstream of billion-dollar industries? You can't create a Walmart. We can't create an Apple. We're not into that realm of things. We can't trade oil. Even though African countries have oil, we still can't get into the distribution of oil and where we can have an opportunity to make billions of dollars. You know, so is that
right? Actually, it's the same thing for the mafia.
Right.
Romans,
true. You're right.
You know, controlled the Romans. You know, had basically conquered everywhere. And so if you were a marginal people and didn't want to be subject to, Roman pimping, then you develop, your sort of alternative system. And that's kind of the thing that black people did. In other words, if a people are going to develop economically, they have to have a politics. And unfortunately, because when blacks came up to Milwaukee, we came largely as individuals. And we were able to earn a great deal of money without any kind of political organization. What you ended up having was a whole lot of marginal individuals who didn't have the social capital and political capital necessary to form bigger organizations and whatnot.
Right.
And that's still the thing now, because one of the things that was systematically done to blacks all around the country is that other groups specifically developed strategies to make certain that we stayed individuals, to make certain that we didn't develop a politics.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Okay, let me ask you, Sister Yon, what do you think that a woman who decides to participate in this pimping game and become the property of a pimp and allow herself to be used in that game. What is the mental process that's necessary, or what is the mental properties that's necessary for her to do that and want to do that and agree to have herself used that way? Help us explain that a little bit. I'm only asking from a woman's perspective. I'm trying to see what is it. Is it economics? Is it the beauty in it? You know, I don't know. I just need to see how a woman thinks about that. What would make a woman even want to consider that? Because you know what you're doing, you've been exploited. But, obviously those that do it don't see it, and there's a lot of them doing it. So, or else it would not exist. It would not be as successful as it is. Give us some insight to the feminine mind as she considers, as we look at this whole pimping game.
Well, for me, I always say I like to keep it simple, and it is still a woman that has a sense of inferiority. She doesn't value herself.
Okay.
There's a level of self-hatred, or she feels that there's no other options,
okay.
That that's her only option. And so she will put herself, you know, in a situation that where she knows how she really feels. Most women that have any sense of self struggle with self-respect and, you know, knowing that they're doing something that is not healthy for them. That is not healthy. You understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's just like a person who eats a lot of junk, hamburgers and sugar and whatnot. You know that's not healthy for you. But you're doing it for whatever payoff you're getting. So a lot of times women, black women, will put themselves in these situations because they're getting a payoff that's worth what they're sacrificing in their mind. I've heard of many sisters, because of course my interest is in black women, that prostitute or allow themselves to be pimped to put themselves through college, you know, or to take care of their children. So, you know, these are the real factors that go into, you know, a woman's thinking. However, when people get older after engaging in, you know, prostituting or letting themselves be pimped or whatever, most realize, you know, that you have sacrificed something. You know, you sacrifice your self-esteem, you sacrifice your health, you know, sexually transmitted diseases, beatings, murders. We haven't talked adequately about the violence. I mentioned it earlier, the violence that black women and women go, you know, are exposed to when they sell their bodies.
Right.
You know, I actually had a friend, she was a white woman, but I actually had a friend who was prostituting. She was a drug addict, and that's another thing, you know, drugs is a huge issue. You know, women will put themselves in all kinds of risky, horrible situations if they're, you know, addicted to drugs. So this woman, she was a heroin addict, and she went to a motel room, you know, to prostitute to get money for drugs. This woman came out of that motel room with her throat slit from ear to ear. And it was a miracle that she didn't die. And she was actually a close friend of mine. And she also came out with AIDS at some point, not from that particular, I mean, who knows what situation, but she also had AIDS. Mm. This woman was a runway model. You know, she also used to brag about, you know, screwing, screwing Mick Jagger, you know. So she had a career, a successful career. I'm sure she did her, you know, her share of prostituting and whatever there. But anyway, that's what happened to her, you know. And so she got her throat slit, and then she died. She died from AIDS. So there are consequences to this stuff.
Yes.
You know, I've heard of women being pistol whipped and, you know, seeing pimps that were extremely, and I still call them clowns and idiots. And if I could cuss, I'd call them some other things, but I'll be nice. But done horrible violence to women that are, you know, selling their bodies for them. So this stuff is serious. There are consequences to our behavior. And we cannot, as a people, we can't make light of this stuff. We've got to see the serious consequences to propagandizing all the negative behaviors and self-destructive. That's the word, the self-destructive behaviors that we do. One last thing, you know, one of the consequences of this pimping thing is that black men are normalizing it, and women.
Yeah.
So women are doing all kinds of degrading things, like you talked about with T.I. You know, that's a shame. That's a shame. Malcolm would say that. That's a shame. And I remember, who was it? Oh, geez. It just went out of my head. But anyway, I'll just say this, and hopefully my thought will return. But there are consequences to this behavior, to these behaviors, and we can't allow the propaganda, you know, to enter into our consciousness without having, again, us counter this with, no, this is not acceptable.
Okay. Okay. I clearly agree with you. Okay, Dr. Belcher, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. you know, falling in the same light of, you know, what Sister Ayan is saying, there's a voluminous amount of women that are participating in, for instance, social media. Because of social media, they're on these different sites. They're twerking. They're showing their beauty and, you know, posing in certain kind of ways. Never mind the strip club prostitution thing. They're just doing this on social media. Is that considered? And I mean, I have asked some, why do you do that? And their answer to me, well, what's wrong with it? You know, we're not doing anything. Just, you know, we got it, flaunt it. Is that correct in looking at it like that? Are they on social media doing some of those things because if you got it, flaunt it? Or is there something else going on in the brain work of things and the mentality of what we are engaged in right now in our life? What do you think? Give us some insight into that.
Well, I do certainly agree with what was just said, and I think there's a part of that that speaks to self-esteem, but if you've never had one, I mean, by that you've never had the, how do we learn by precepts, examples, and repetition? So if all of your precepts and examples as a young woman and repetitions coming up is seeing this thing, this thing, this thing, this, then that becomes your new normal. That becomes your normal, all you know normal. Not new normal, all you know normal.
Right.
So what you're describing is some of that Instagram modeling stuff. You know, you got people like, I named one young woman, Black China, who, you know, was doing that kind of stuff and doing parties and strip clubs. And to most of these, a lot of younger, she made it, you know, whatever made it is. And let me just raise the, you know, just not raise, let me lower the bar a little further. And say, I look at the Kardashians, every one of them, to me, is that, you know? Okay. What are you famous for? What are you famous for, woman? What do you do? What are you saying? You're famous for, you know, altering your body, showing it, taking pictures of it, you know, going to parties and getting black men to marry you for it. I mean, you're famous for that. You know, it's the same thing.
Right.
But I reject this. I reject this as a part of my black culture, as being normal. I reject it. And it's something that was pressed upon us from days gone by, brought it all the way up through the 70s, and thank God we migrated out of that. And for some reason, in 2020, in this other new decade, we have certain people in the entertainment community that know better, can do better, should care more, bring this mess back up like this here again. Now, there's a reason why we migrated out of this from this 1972 up to 2000. Okay, there's a reason for that.
Okay.
And I know it's taken some different shapes and form, but this is not normal. It is not normal for young girls to show everything they can on Instagram and Facebook and all these things. It's not normal.
Right.
And somebody needs to cry loud and spare not. You know, and I do, and others do. People on this program are doing it.
And who needs to do that? Who do you think should stand up and call this out?
All of us.
Okay.
Every single solitary one of us. And you call it out where it is. And I think we're afraid, almost afraid of our youth. You know, we're almost, when I was a young woman coming up, and it was really, when I was a young woman coming up, you know, and I came through the miniskirt year with the hot pants, you know, all like that there. You know, but I had women in my community, be it in my neighborhood or at church or in my school, say, you know, they come up, just pull on your skirt, just pull it.
Right.
You know, pull it down, you know, pull that down, baby. And then I was taught, you know, give them something to wonder about, baby. You know, I had older women teach me, you know how to get a man? Give him something to wonder about. If he got to see it all, he's been blessed already. You know, he should be able to make him want it, and then don't give it to him. That's how you get a man. I was taught how to get men without giving up my body.
Right.
And nobody's teaching these young women how to get not men, but a man like a man, like a for a husband, you know, a companion, a lifelong partner. And that's the other piece of this. We're so into dating, we forgot we're supposed to be looking for our partner.
Right.
We're looking for our partner.
I like that.
Not just the next guy you lay with or the next woman you lay with. So the whole construct that we're living under in terms of our sexuality, how we build our relationships, how we dress as women, how we act as men, is grounded in a European construct that we learned in slavery.
Right.
And we've never unlearned it.
That's right.
We have to go back to our original construct for Black people, which is what? The African construct. How we live, how we act, how we raise our daughters, how we raise our sons.
I like that. Brother Timothy, I know the nation trains its women. What is it called? The MIG? What is that organization?
MGC class.
Say it again.
That's right. Yes, and they have classes, and today the women are highly educated. You have PhDs there now. You have accountants, and you have folks who have real estate, and some people who are just readers.
Okay.
Who have businesses. So the MGT class is vast and wide now. And they also teach how to cook and sew and all those good things that go along with it. But I want to add something. I want to start with Oscar Michel, and who did independent film in the
20s. Right.
I want to start with Paul Robeson and Hattie McDaniels, right? And I want to say what has evolved in film to Cotton Comes to Harlem with Ozzie Davis, and he went to Hollywood, and they looked at him, and he said, I want blacks in film. Well, they made him an offer. He said, look, I don't have much money. He said, we'll give you a cheap budget. And Cotton Comes to Harlem is about, unfortunately, narcotics and heroin in the cotton bale.
Right.
So when people are hungry and want something, white folks in Hollywood, which is nothing but a racist organization, if you come to them, you're not going to come with them with a true black story. They're going to fictionalize it, and they're going to go against everything that's in your culture. So when I did a lot of a reading on Ryan O'Neal, people don't know this. Ryan O'Neal was a Shakespearean actor. He was good in Hamlet. And when Superfly was produced, and the matter of fact, the was from a guy from Philadelphia named Sonny Q.
Okay.
He was in Europe. And when he came back, they met him at the airport. They said, this movie was great. He said, you like that? And they bought it. So if you go to Hollywood and you expect them to do something that's positive for us, so you respect a guy like Spike Lee, that he does the films that he does. Because anytime a person like Eddie Murphy sells out, and the rest of these clowns, that's what, you want to be a clown? Go with them. They'll make you a clown. And it's up to us, like I told you, Dr. Rogers, same thing with the movie Harriet. And now today, we don't have to settle for crap. If you want crap, you get it.
Right.
We have to do positive things with film and music and education.
Mm-hmm.
It's up to us now.
Okay.
Yeah.
You got all these avenues now. We have money with the athletics, with movies. We have people who are entertainers. We have people who are professional people. You have to control your own destiny the way you want it to go. Now, if you let somebody come in your culture, they're going to alter it. That's up to you. It's up to you to keep your culture going.
I like that. Brother Pugh, we've got a little bit less than a half hour to go. How do you see rectifying some of this in our community? How do we, is there a way to bring change here? Is there a way to sort of resurrect a new way of thinking and looking as we interact? Because you're talking about male and female. That's what you're talking about. We're talking about the very essence of what makes life, the man and the woman. We talk about families. What is family, male and female? And that's why this is such a critical discussion, because these are some of the barriers to bringing male and female together. And so because of that, you know, we have to address the most intricate details of things that are going on in our community that could disrupt that process. So let me ask you, do you see where there might be a way that we can begin to resurrect a new way of thinking?
Yes, of course. It's It's the combination of values, sex, and money. And right now, you know, we're when you operate from a capitalist paradigm, you know, as individuals, you know, you can, you know, there are no norms there, and you end up doing whatever you think is going to enable you to be successful.
That's exactly
right. But I think that I think the Wakanda vision, which I call, by the way, the sacred world, where people begin to see themselves as persons and families. These families are parts of communities. These communities are parts of societies. And these societies exist within ecologies. If they start seeing themselves as part of a sacred world and begin to do the things to essentially reconstitute this sacred world, well, then you really won't need pimps and players and hustlers and hoes and all of these kinds of things.
Right.
There's probably 20 minutes left, so we can continue the conversation for those.
Okay, I'm back.
I agree.
I have it.
I agree.
Thank you.
Yeah, and hope that he comes back on before.
Yeah.
Can you hear me? I'm back on. Can you hear me?
There we go.
Okay. I'm sorry.
He was going to carry on for you.
Going,
that's all right. That's good. I appreciate you. Yeah, do that. If it ever happens, you know, just go on with the conversation, and that's great. But I wanted to you know, because like I said, we only got a few more minutes, and I wanted to make sure that I use this. There's a brother, his name was, he was reading the announcement, and he made a suggestion. His name was Brother Wilkins. He is from Seattle, Washington. And he said that, I asked him the question that I asked Brother Pugh, about how do we resurrect or correct this condition. And he suggested that we remember Henry Highland Garnett's speech to the slaves of America. That was the name of it. It's a speech that was done around 1843. And he's telling them about the condition and what has to be done to change that condition. And so I want to recommend to our audience to take a look at Henry Highland Garnett's speech. It is on YouTube. It's called A Speech to the Slaves in 1843. And very clearly, what he is saying is the same thing that David Walker says in his appeal. That's why I played David Walker's appeal. The few introductory opening to his book, David Walker's Appeal, as what needs to be done among those of us that are in captivity. And that's really all of us. So African, you're all of us in captivity. So both Henry Highland Garnett as well as David Walker, I did take a look at that. So I appreciate Brother Wilkins' suggestion to take a look at that again as a way of solution, because I clearly say that you must look at the economics of things. There's no way to get around that, and looking at the economics would then make a lot of sense, because you know you've got young women today. 18, 19-year-olds with two children, no man, no husband.
Abandoned.
Trying to raise their children. Grandmothers who are 35 years old, who themselves don't have meals to help them. And an opportunity is presented to them to make some money so that they can buy decent furniture in their house or clothing for their children or do whatever. You know, it creates this situation that we're talking about. Now, clearly not everybody who's struggling does that, but it does open right. up possibilities. And even if it's not done at the level of strip clubs or pimping, it's done in a smaller version of that, which I still say is a part of the mentality of all of that. I used to hear a joke all the time. They said guys would go around and say, if you want to get your woman, you want to find your woman, wait till about November, right before Thanksgiving. You can get your one. Because at that point, Christmas is coming, and they're looking for somebody to do something. And it's that kind of thinking that I think is so disruptive to our community, and which is what we have to address. And obviously, to address that economic part is going to just take more than talking. We're going to have to really begin to do some things. And I want to have one of our programs coming up on looking at grassroots economics, which we may have to look at. Sometimes we are...
Dr. Hutchins.
Yeah, just one second. Sometimes we have put things in our face and, you know, you see the Walmarts, the Bill Gates and Warren Buffetts and all of that. And, you know, that's another whole aspiration of economics. That's not what we're talking about in our community. We're talking about building in a way that becomes sustainable. That's another whole game of playing economics, but that's not what we should be looking at. We should be looking at what the principles of Kwanzaa talk about. Umoja, mm-hmm. and Ujima, mm-hmm. and those kinds of things. So anyway, mm-hmm. yes, ma'am. Mr. Dr. Belcher, you had a question?
I just wanted to address what you said about the economics, you know, with here in Wisconsin, you know, being one of the most poorest states in the union for black people to live in,
mm-hmm.
And the most racist state in the union of states in the United States. So all of those things do play a part in it. But what concerns me about the economics piece, yes, there's the economics where, you know, she's, you know, I wasn't, you know, my mother wasn't always, you know, where we were at later in her life when she remarried. And I remember a one day visibly walking down the street with her. My mom was crying, and I think she was holding my hand, and I had a baby in her arm and another one. I don't know what was going on, but my mom was crying. And my mother would tell us the story later in life how she had no food for us. She had nothing for us. And she was just walking down the street with her kids crying. And I remember this man who came up to her and asked her why she was crying. But I was like young, like 6 years old. And he gave her money to feed her kids, for her to go get some food and feed us. So what I'm saying is, why are black men exploiting the economics of black women who may be single mothers or who needs food at Thanksgiving or things for Christmas? Why, where is the chivalry? Right. Where is that? I mean, yes, we are poor in this country as a whole. Okay. You know, we're like a less than a fraction of the 1% of the rich, of that 1% who are rich. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we are historically poor. So does that then give black men a right to exploit her because she's hungry, or her children are hungry, or she doesn't have this or doesn't have that? Where is the chivalry where he can say, you know what, I'm going to help her to feed her kids, and she ain't got to open her legs for me to get to do it?
Right.
You
right.
understand?
Yeah. And actually, you know what, that's a real good point to bring up, because there are some things that I clearly we would have to discuss. And if there's any of the brothers here that would want to chime in on this, but I think it really speaks to a discussion on how we see this high level of sexuality that we live in this culture, and how we look at women in relationship to that high level of sexuality. And I think there's something driving all of that. I'm not quite sure. Can articulate it real clearly, but I think there's something driving that in men. And the brothers, you know, many of you might have some idea of that, because, like, for instance, if you want to go out on the town for an evening. It usually eventually may or could possibly get into the possibility of a sexual confrontation in some way, or that's the purpose of going out. So I don't know what is it that we are doing that's driving that creates this high level of sexuality among ourselves that you like.
Dr. Rogers, I'm sorry. Can I jump in just real
quick? Yeah, go right ahead.
Look, because of the fact that there are some things that are playing right in front of our eyes. One, I think, is that of a different kind and type of politic, namely the LGBTQIXYZ politic, right?
Okay,
and
okay.
So we've got to be able to confront and talk to them like they want to talk to us about the realities and the kinds and types of definitions that's coming up. For example, their definitions and ideas of family and family value, which is totally on the other side of what we're used to, right? We've become fragmented. We have to admit that we have become fragmented. And as I say that, I want to lift up ancestor Dolores Tucker, who was a fighter against gangster rap and her beliefs in Philadelphia. And so the thing about it is that can we really honestly and openly sit down and talk and have engaging dialogue on this? It's as though we're overseeing, it's the pink elephant in the room. And so, do we want to be able to look at this? Because it seems as though everyone else is creating their ideas of the construct of family, and then all of a sudden the ones that we once had is now being diluted. No disrespect to lesbian sisters, and I really don't, but there's a thing that gets me. It really does. When they want to confront me as a man, and I have to always keep in the forefront of my mind, they're women, right? And so, but if you're going to come at me like that, then what, I'm supposed to cower down? I'm supposed to all of a sudden become effeminized? No. No, and so sometimes we just have to take a stand and be able to confront them and be able to talk to them just like they talk to us and be able to say, this is the ground I stand on. So now look, go away with this foolishness.
Okay.
So I don't know, I just had to bring that up.
That's good. That's right.
I'm overly emotional.
That's clear and right to the point. Sister,
I want to say something too before we end. I know I'm not a
man. Go right ahead. Please go right ahead. I was getting ready to call on you.
Okay, good. Because I want everybody to please keep this in mind. Whenever there's a negative scourge in our communities and we push it back down, the forces that be, I don't like to call them powers, but the forces that be that control and oppress and savagely abuse us, they find a way to pull that stuff back up.
Okay.
Because there was a time when pimping was like, oh, no, we ain't doing that no more. That's, you ain't no good if you do that to our women. There was a time that we had that attitude. All of a sudden, it rises back up. There was a time when we were saying we were getting out of drugs, we're getting out of crack, blah, blah, blah. And then it's rising back up. There are forces that are pushing these agendas. That brother got me stirred up to just talk. I love what you were saying. But there are forces that are pushing these things, again, propagandizing and pushing these self-destructive behaviors to black folks specifically. I'm going to give you a quick example. When you talked about Snoop Dogg when he came out with the women on a leash, I can't remember if they were black women, yes?
Yeah, they were black women.
Okay.
Yeah, they were.
So remember when Snoop Dogg was doing, Girls Gone Wild. They had white girls, going wild on some, but they kept promoting that, and that was a big, big thing. You all remember that?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes.
So that was just kind of an autonomous thing that two white guys were doing. They had the great idea of bringing Snoop Dogg in as the pimp for Girls Gone Wild. The pimp figure for Girls Gone Wild. And they took that whole thing off when they had a black man acting as if he was pimping white women, just projecting the image. Now, he wasn't doing it, for entertainment purposes. Well, they took that off in a hurry. But when he does that, when black men do it to black women, they keep on promoting this. So please pay attention to the powers that, or the forces that are actually creating all of this BS.
That's
in our
exactly
community.
Right. And they're doing it through entertainment. It's being done, a lot of it through entertainment.
And yeah, and they're just exploiting us. And then because of our psychological damage, we got to understand psychology, because that's another weapon that's used against us.
Right.
The very thing we don't understand is psychology. It's the weapon that they're using against us. We got to understand the psychology of self-hatred and why we feed it to this stuff. Because we don't have to. We have other ways of making money. We did it when we built our black city.
Right.
We built Black Wall Street and Haiti and all of that. So we know how to make money.
Yeah, we know how to make, definitely know how to make
money.
That's
right.
That's exactly right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think that you have, we did definitely hit a part of the nail on the head that we want to do. We're going to have to review this again. There's no way we cannot do that, because, again, it affects family. It affects community. And these are things that are destructive behavior. I remember asking, we were mentoring a school in Milwaukee, and I remember asking a seven-year-old young man, 7 years old, what did he want to be when he grew up? He said, I want to be a porno star. And I said, a what? He said, a porno star. I said, you don't even know what a porno star is. What are you talking about? He said, yes, I do. It's having sex in the movies. And I said to him, you got to be kidding me. Where did you hear that from? Such and such and such. And then he said, okay. I'll be a pimp. That kind of behavior. So today that young man is probably about 15. This was about 8-9 years ago. No telling where he is and what he's doing. But let me say to you, my brothers and sisters, we've got to think about these things. We've got to come up with plans, ideas. As Brother Pugh said, let's go back and read Henry Highland Garnett, David Walker's appeal. Let's look at some of the language that's being used and said in the plans that were being offered. The Honorable Marcus Scarvey, Elijah Muhammad, they had the blueprint for this. We just got to implement it. We're not implementing it, and we're losing touch of that. So by all means, read Henry Highland Garnett's speech. I think you will find that invigorating, as well as David Walker's appeal. Thank you so much. Have a great week coming up, and we will see you again next Tuesday. Good night.
Is the father, the son, is the center of the earth, in the middle of the universe, then why is this verse coming 6 times rehearsed? Don't freestyle much, but I write them like such.
Word.
Amongst the fiends controlled by the screens, what does it all mean, all this I'm seeing? Human beings screaming vocal javelins, sign of a local unraveling.
Uh-huh.
My wandering got my wondering, where Christ is in all this crisis. Hating Satan never knew what nice is. Check the papers, well, I bet on ISIS. More than your eye can see and ears can hear. Year by year, all the sense disappears. Nonsense perseveres, prayers laced with fear. Beware, 2-triple O.
It might feel good, it might sound a little something. But damn the game, if it don't mean nothing. What is game? Who got game? Where's the game in life? Behind the game, I got game, she got game. Got game, they got game, he got game. It might feel good, it might sound a little something, but the game if it ain't saying nothing.
Damn, was it something I said? Pretend you don't see, so you turn your head. Race scared of his shadow, does it matter? Thought of reparations, got a plan with the population. Nothing to lose, everything's approved. People use, even murder's excused. White men in suits don't have to jump. Still 1,001 ways to lose with the shoes. God takes care of old folks and fools, while the devil takes care of making all the rules. Folks don't even own themselves, paying mental rent to corporate presidents. 1 out of 1 million residents, be a dissident who ain't kissing it. The politics are chains and whips, got the sick missing chips and all the championships. What's love got to do with what you got? Don't let a win get to your head or a loss to your heart. Nonsense perseveres, prayers laced with fear. Beware, 2-triple O is
near. It might feel good, it might sound a little something. But damn the game, if it don't mean nothing. What is game? Who got game? Where's the game in life? Behind the game, I got game. game, she got game, we got game, they got game, he got game. It might feel good, it might sound a little something, but the game, if it ain't something.